Chapter 12. Praying for a Second Chance. It was much easier to catch a flight to Nova Scotia on a moment's notice than either Peter or his parents had supposed, or maybe they were just very fortunate. By 9 o'clock the next morning, they were all aboard a Boeing 737. Since they were flying standby, they didn't have a choice of seats. Jim and Mary were thankful to be across the aisle from one another, while Peter was situated near the back, marvelling that he had been given a window seat. Next to him was a businessman with a laptop computer, and an elderly woman on the aisle. Peter was tired, he was worried, and he was in great distress. He had never expected his trip to Canada to be so traumatic. In Australia, his life had been incredibly busy, but it had also been pleasantly predictable. Every morning he'd risen early and headed off to work, eating breakfast on the run. He loved his job. His labourers were a jolly crew, perhaps not the best-mannered gentlemen and rather crude at times, but well-meaning and easy enough to get along with. He couldn't remember ever fighting back tears in Australia. He'd simply refused to think about things that hurt. His life had been motivated by an honest desire to please his customers, make a good wage, enjoy life to the fullest, and head off to the ocean every weekend with his surfboard. Yet here he was, after only 1 week of vacation, having actually cried more than once in the last few days, having narrowly escaped death in a burning church, and now flying standby to Nova Scotia because of his brother's heart attack. What was going on? This was supposed to be a 3 week holiday, not an experience to turn his life upside down. Once again, Peter found himself silently pleading, "Please spare James's life." Once again, he stopped himself. He didn't feel he was ready to pray to God, and he wasn't even sure that God would want to listen. "But who else is there to turn to?" he agonized. "Who else claims power over life and death? Surely God won't snatch away another person that I love, will he? Just when I've finally decided to search things out?" But it had happened once, so maybe it would happen again. Trying to escape from his anxious thoughts, Peter knew he had to find something to occupy his mind. He reached into his backpack to pull out one of his mum's books. Last night he'd hastily stuffed a number of things into his backpack. Not only had he included two more novels, he'd also brought the Antichrist study sheets that Thomas had given him, his old Bible, and a pen. As Peter rummaged through his bag to find the book Desecration, he brushed against the study sheets. For a moment he hesitated, trying to decide what to choose. The novels were entertaining and light, and he was curious to find out what happened next when the Antichrist of Left Behind took control of the new temple. However, at the cemetery the night before, he'd promised to search the matter out. Already he had a fairly good understanding of what the authors of Left Behind believed. If the Bible was truly God's prophetic word, then it made sense to begin his research straight from the source. Even so, Peter sighed heavily when he pulled out his Bible. He was intrigued. He was curious, but he felt that doing personal Bible study was essentially giving in. Pulling the study sheets out of his bag, Peter glanced at the very first question. It said, "What does the word Antichrist mean?" It seemed fairly obvious to Peter that Antichrist meant someone against Christ. Nevertheless, he read the definition that was given from Strong's Concordance. He pondered to himself. "So the word can also mean in the room of, or substitution. Does that mean that Antichrist will try to be a substitute for Jesus Christ?" The point didn't seem to be all that significant, but he included it in his answer anyway. Peter was surprised to discover that Jesus had warned his disciples about false Christs. In Matthew chapter 24, Jesus foretold many things that would happen before he returned to the earth again. He said, "Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, 'I am Christ,' and shall deceive many. If any man shall say unto you, 'Lo, here is Christ,' or 'There,' believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect." That last part of the verse sounds just like the Antichrist in Left Behind, Peter thought, showing great signs and wonders, deceiving. However, Jesus also said there would be many false Christs, not just one. A section on lies and truth took Peter a while to work through, but as he looked up the various references, he came to appreciate that God hates lying, especially when it comes from religious leaders who influence others. Liars will have no place in God's kingdom. Lies are the reason why so many people continue to sin. When misguided leaders promise life to the wicked, they deprive them of any motivation to change. In Paul's letter to Timothy, he warned that many people would like to hear lies more than truth and will leave behind true teaching for fables. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 impressed Peter the most. The passage had been quoted in the Left Behind series, so he knew it had something to do with Antichrist. In verses 9 to 12 it said, "The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they may all be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness." The sharp words challenged Peter and gave him cause for concern. What was this strong delusion or lie that God would send? It didn't seem fair that God would do such a thing. But the same passage also inferred that only those who had a love of the truth would be saved, because they wouldn't believe the lie. Was salvation really dependent upon truth? And how could one be certain they had found the truth? After he was well into the study, Peter remembered how much he had once enjoyed such an exercise. It wasn't that hard, really. It was just a matter of reading carefully, checking cross-references, asking questions, and searching until you found the answers. The study sheets were only a basis on which to begin the search. The deeper one searched, the more they became enlightened. The only trouble was, such a spiritual exercise also stirred up his conscience, a conscience that had long been rejected and scorned, but never totally destroyed. Taking a break from his work and looking out the small window of the aircraft, Peter realized he had a marvelous view. Lakes and rivers, green pastures and harvested fields made an interesting patchwork quilt. It was also tiny and miniature. Houses were difficult to spot, never mind the people who lived in them. "This is what God sees," Peter reflected. "We're all so tiny, so insignificant from way up here. It's a wonder that he cares. If he does, that is." And yet already, with only a little spirituality trickling back into his life, Peter knew better than to question whether God cared. He thought back on the lonely, dark hour he'd spent at the cemetery. Was that to be his final resting place, death and nothing more? What if he was the one lying in hospital right now, recovering from a heart attack? Would he be struggling to live, or content to give up and die? Peter shuddered. He knew he wanted life, and he wanted it to go on, forever. For a long time, Peter allowed his conscience free rein, not trying to escape the debate that raged within his mind. At last he decided that even though he still had a lot of changes to make in his life and in his thoughts, it was time to apologize. Apologize to God. He didn't feel he could honestly beg for God's help with James and truly endeavor to understand God's word while he still harbored bitterness and anger. It would be hypocritical towards any friend, and Peter was sure it must be even more so towards a God who knows every thought. "Dear God," he prayed silently, suppressing all his stiff, icy-cold thoughts of resistance. "I know I've been running away from you. So many times I've spoken against you. I've questioned your wisdom. I've accused you of being uncaring and cruel. I've refused to believe your promises, and even now I know I'm greatly lacking in faith. I want to turn back to you. I want to have faith. I want to love truth. And please," he sighed heavily, "even though I'm not worthy of any favors, if it's possible, please don't let James die. Please give both of us a second chance." Neither the elderly lady nor the man with the laptop computer had any idea that Peter had just made a remarkable revolution in his life. But he had. And while it couldn't be said that his frozen heart had completely thawed, or that all his mental anguish had suddenly vanished, there was certainly a bright little spark of joy flickering up within. At least now he knew he wanted to head in a different direction, and he was willing to admit that he needed God's help to do so. The Bryants arrived in Nova Scotia shortly before noon and waited outside to catch a taxi to the hospital in Stirling. They were surprised the airport was so far away from the city. A stewardess had told them that it would take at least half an hour to reach the downtown. Jim Bryant tried again to call Andrew using his cell phone. However, there was still only an answering machine at the other end. "There must be 15 messages on that machine by now," Peter's dad fretted. Once they were in the taxi, he tried again, but to no avail. "It's only because he's so busy serving the Lord," Mary gently reminded her husband. I know, but where on earth could they be? Then it dawned on all of them. It was Sunday morning. Andrew and Lisa would be at church. Where they'd been the night before was still undetermined, but there was no point in calling again for the next few hours. On the way to the airport, Peter marvelled at all the lakes and forests they passed along the way. "It hasn't changed much out here in the last 10 years," he said to his mum. "No, it's still pristine and beautiful," she agreed. When they arrived nervously at the hospital, Peter's dad inquired where they would find James Bryant. The receptionist directed them to the intensive care ward on the third floor. Together they made their way up to the nurse's station, once again explaining who they were. A doctor who had cared for James in the critical hours the day before kindly offered to lead Jim and Mary to their son's bedside. Only 2 visitors were allowed in at a time. Peter waited in a small lounge nearby while his parents washed their hands and followed the doctor into the unit. Many years had gone by since he'd last seen his brothers, and Peter wondered how much James had changed. Always very lean and the tallest in the family, James had been a good-looking young man with thoughtful brown eyes and a gentle manner. While Peter and Andrew were fair, James's dark curly hair and high cheekbones gave him a unique appearance. He wasn't really like either of his brothers. "So is he going to make it?" Peter heard his father ask anxiously in the hallway as they were returning from the unit. "I've seen far worse," the doctor stated confidently. "Your son was sitting in emergency when he had the heart attack, so we were able to get to work on him right away." He paused and then asked, "It's very unusual for someone so young to have such an attack. Is there anything in the family history?" "My brother died of the same thing when he was only 25, Mary admitted sadly. "I'm sorry to hear that," the doctor replied sincerely. "That must have been quite a shock to you all." Nodding his head slowly, he reflected, "Most likely, then, James has a genetic weakness. Anyway, your son's attack was so severe that it was necessary to give him an immediate triple bypass. Barring any unforeseen complications, he should make a steady progress. If all goes well, he should be well enough to go home in 2 weeks." "Really?" Peter's mum sounded elated. But he looks so ill." "Open heart surgery is rather hard on a guy," the doctor said. "But he's young, he'll heal fast. So long as he takes it easy, he should make a full recovery." Looking up at the ceiling, Peter breathed a huge sigh of relief. The doctor's optimistic prognosis alleviated his burden of anxiety. "Thank you, God," Peter whispered as the others entered the waiting room. Handing Peter a gown to put over his clothes, the doctor explained that he had to attend to some other patients, but Peter was welcome to visit James on his own if he liked. "Just don't forget to wash your hands," he reminded him, heading off down the hall. "Keep it to 2 at a time and check with the nurse first." Peter's dad accompanied him into the room, explaining that James was in a medically induced coma to give his body complete rest. Even though Peter expected his brother to have changed over the years, he wasn't prepared for the changes he saw. James had put on some weight, and his dark curly hair was flecked with grey. With his eyes closed and his face pale and expressionless, he didn't look like the brother Peter remembered. He lay so still on the bed that it was hard to believe he was actually alive. Machines beeped and flashed all around him, and tubes protruded in various places, branching off to several bags of liquid. "Oh, James," Peter said sadly, as he reached out to hold one of his brother's limp, motionless hands. "Where have the years gone?" For a while, Peter and his dad sat by James's bed, saying very little, but glad to be close by. The doctor's optimistic report was surprisingly reassuring, and they hoped he was right. "He's a good man," Jim Bryant said, breaking the silence. "James has always been honest and hard-working and generous to those in need." Peter nodded in agreement. There had been other occasions when his parents had grieved over James's lack of commitment to church, his workaholic tendency, and a common law relationship that had ended bitterly. But in the last few years, James had given generously of both his time and money, sponsoring and coaching a hockey team for underprivileged boys. He'd even been recognised in the daily newspaper as Sterling's Big Brother of the Year. As the afternoon wore on, Jim Bryant was still unable to make contact with his eldest son. Mary began perusing the pile of magazines beside her chair, and Peter pulled out his mum's copy of Desecration. He wanted to find out what would happen next to Buck and Rayford, and how Carpathia would desecrate the Temple of God. At the moment, with James in a coma, there wasn't a whole lot to do. Near dinner time, Peter volunteered to pick up something to eat. While he was interested in the books he was reading, he was also finding them rather depressing. He hoped he would never have to face the intense persecution and terrible ordeals that the main characters were going through. It worried him. In fact, it frightened him. He couldn't imagine finding the courage to resist wearing a mark if his very life was at stake. He knew that he would never forget the things he was reading in these books, true or not. They were changing his whole perspective on life. More than anything, he was becoming very concerned about the future. After walking briskly for several blocks in order to stretch his legs, Peter finally found a place where he could purchase something for dinner. As Peter returned to the hospital entrance with three large submarine sandwiches in a bag, a man who seemed to be in a dreadful hurry brushed past him. Glancing over, it didn't take long for Peter to recognize who it was. The man's wavy blonde hair was neat and well-groomed, and his intense blue eyes were filled with alarm. Aside from being a little heavier around the middle, he'd hardly changed at all. "Andrew!" Peter called out as the man hurried on. "Andrew Bryant!" Peter's shout drew the attention of everyone who was standing around. Andrew stopped in his tracks and turned sharply. His look of surprise quickly turned to joyful recognition. In such tragic circumstances, the lack of communication and vastly different directions in life seemed completely unimportant. Peter felt that he'd never been so glad to see his oldest brother, and Andrew seemed to feel the same. With a few quick steps forward, they threw their arms around one another. "It's been ages since I've seen you," Andrew remarked sadly. "And James was looking forward to your visit so much. Is he okay?" Andrew asked anxiously as they began walking down the hall together. "Is he going to be all right?" Peter smiled with a shrug. "The doctor seems to think James will be fine." They walked into the small waiting room. "I'm so sorry you haven't been able to get in touch with me sooner," Andrew apologized earnestly, greeting his parents with a great deal of love and concern. "Where have you been?" Jim exclaimed. "Lisa and I were at a Christian retreat all week with the family. We only got home half an hour ago, and I came directly here as soon as I heard the messages. I just can't believe this has happened," Andrew grieved. "James was over at our place last weekend, and he seemed perfectly healthy." "So there were no indications that he was having heart problems?" Jim asked. "Well, he was telling me how tired he'd been feeling lately, but he's been doing considerable overtime at work, like always, so I didn't think much of it. I just thought he was working too hard." "They did a triple bypass," Mary stated. "Can I see him?" Andrew pleaded. For the next half an hour, Andrew and his mother spent time with James, while Peter and his dad started on the sandwiches. As soon as Andrew returned, he invited everyone to come back to his place for the night. "It's getting late," he said, "and there's nothing any of us can do for James right now. Lisa and the kids can't wait to see you all." He clapped Peter on the shoulder. "And you're the uncle they don't even know." Peter smiled up at his older brother. Andrew was as intense as ever. There was something about his confident persuasiveness that made him a natural leader. Rising from his chair and picking up his belongings, Peter was more than happy to follow him out the door.